This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
A simple and straightforward shiur, and not a very long one, on a concept starting off with an idea that we developed last night, which I'll repeat briefly, and developing that idea a little further. The Midrash says, "On nefesh ki takriv korban." If a person is to bring a korban, the Midrash compares the two different types of korbanos that the Torah refers to, the two different types of sacrifices, the two different objects brought as sacrifices. On the one hand, the bird. On the other hand, the behemoth, the cattle. And the difference being that in the case of the cattle, the entire animal is used on the Mizbeach, whereas in the case of the bird, the stomach of the bird is rejected, is not used on the Mizbeach. And the reason is, Rabbi Tanchuma says, Ha'ifazeh poreach v'tas b'chol ha'ilom, the bird flies all over the world, Va'ichel b'chol tzad, and it eats wherever it is, wherever it finds food. Va'ichel min ha'gzeilus u min ha'chamosim, and it eats food which doesn't belong to it and doesn't belong to its owner. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Hashem, ho'il v'hazefek hazeh mole gzeilus v'chamosim, since the stomach of this bird is full of food that has been seeds and things that have been stolen, al yikorev legabi ha'mizbeach, it may not be brought on the Mizbeach. Mekach ne'amar v'hisir es murosoi, and therefore it says its inside must be removed. Aval behemo bet cattle gedelo al evus balo, that animal, a domestic animal, is brought up in the at the trough, at the feeding furrow of its owner. Ve'eno echeles mikol tzad, and it doesn't just eat wherever it goes. Lo min hagzeilus v'lo min hachamosim, it doesn't eat stolen property, doesn't eat thieved property. Lefichoch hi makrivo kulo, therefore it is brought in its entirety on the altar. Lechach ne'ema, that's why it says, Vihikriv hakohen es hakol hamizbecha. But the kohen can bring the entire animal onto the mizbech. And although even the bird has no intent to steal, even the bird has no knowledge that it's stealing, the bird has no conscience, the bird has no awareness, nevertheless there's something not pure about it. And that minute degree of impurity in the sustenance of the bird is sufficient to puzzle the bird, to disqualify the bird as far as the Ribbono Shel Olam is concerned. As minute as it is, as tiny, as unimportant as it appears to be, to the Ribbono Shel Olam it's not unimportant. When it comes to matters of gezeilah, when it comes to matters of taking things and possessing things which are not one's own, Hashem takes a very serious view on that. So he doesn't want that the stomach must be removed. The cattle, though, is a different story. The cattle people know who the cattle belong to. If one finds cattle in one's property that doesn't belong to oneself, one asks for compensation from the owner. So it emerges that very seldom, if ever, does the cattle find itself eating in a field which doesn't belong to its owner. And therefore the cattle can be brought in its entirety. And we discussed last night that we see here a tendency as far as Kodshim is concerned, as far as the Mizbeach is concerned, and we see it right through the Sefer Vayikra, we see it right through the book of Vayikra and right through Seder Kodshim, that there is what has commonly become known as a quest for zero defect, an intolerance of any imperfection no matter how small. And we see that in Kodshim altogether, that any imperfection, anything that in the animal which is physically imperfect, any limb which is not perfect, any of the animal's functions which are not perfect, disqualifies the animal from the Mizbeach. The animal is kosher, the animal may be eaten, the animal may be used for other purposes, but not for the Mizbeach, not for the altar. So we have one place in the world where the requirements there are perfection, and anything less than perfection is disqualified. But the Midrash goes on to talk about the human being. What about man? We've always said man isn't perfect. No man is perfect. We all do things that aren't entirely right. And even the Kohanim. So what is the role of man in this environment which is designed for perfection? It's true that we see a case where the Torah seeks perfection in the birth and removes the stomach because there's a small item of imperfection in the stomach. It's true the Torah seeks perfection in the animal and finds perfection in the animal and insists on perfection on any object that's brought onto the Mizbeach. But what about man, who plays a part there too? Man surely cannot be treated as perfect? And if so, what is his role in this environment of perfection in the Beis HaMikdash? So the Medrash goes on to talk about that and says, "Lefi shehanefesh hazu gozeles v'chomeses." When it comes to a human being, since a human being is inevitably involved in theft and deceit and dishonesty, since a human being is inevitably involved in deceit and dishonesty and theft, that's the strange things. Come and see what pain and suffering and toil goes into the digestion of the human being's food. And the Medrash then relates the whole process of digestion, from the mouth to the throat and from the throat to the stomach, and so it goes through all the processes that the food has to go in the process of digestion. And we asked last night, what is the one going to do with the other? Why has the digestive process brought as having anything to do with whatever with man's tendency to be to deceit and to dishonesty and to theft? And we explained last night that zero defect can be sought in objects, that zero defect cannot be sought in subjects. People, when it comes to people, there's no such thing as zero defect, and we're going to discuss why that is. In an object you can have zero defect. You can create an object with a virtual absence of any imperfection. And we see such a thing in the bird as well. Apart from the gzela, take out the stomach and the bird is perfect. The cattle, the animal that is brought on the korban, perfect. One can achieve a degree of near perfection in the inanimate world. But when it comes to human beings, you can't. Ein tzaddik ba'oretz asher yaseh tov v'lo yechtol. There is no such thing as a tzaddik who does good and doesn't sin. It doesn't exist. That's against the very essence of humanity. This is a strange concept. That means that there is more perfection in the animal world than there is in the human world, which altogether is an interesting concept. But what has the digestive process got to do with it? And we explained last night that the Medrash is showing us how to handle imperfection. That imperfection is not handled in the human realm by cutting out any imperfect parts. When it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, when it comes to the altar and the Mizbeach, Hashem treats it that way. Any imperfection, remove it. The stomach of the bird is imperfect, it has stolen property in it, remove the stomach. But when it comes to life, we can't operate that way. If we sat around here, if I said that this Motzei Shabbos Shir, the only perfect people can participate. Anybody who's not a perfect tzaddik can't participate. And anybody who's not a perfect tzaddik will have to leave. One by one, everybody would have to leave, including me. So it just doesn't work that way. You can't operate that way. If we're going to remove imperfection from the realm of human life, we're going to remove humanity. There is built-in imperfection in humanity. It's a necessary part of life, that imperfection. And what we need to know is, how do we relate to perfection, to imperfection, in a system of perfection? Because the Torah is a perfect system. This is a system designed by the Ribbono Shel Olam. So we're involved in perfection. We're involved in the pursuit of perfection. We're involved in a system designed by He who is all perfect and desires perfection. And we ourselves are not and cannot be perfect. So how do we relate to it? How do we handle it? And of course, everybody underrates his own imperfections and overrates everybody else's imperfections. So it can become altogether very irritating. Explains the Medrash. So look at the human body, and you'll see from the body, you'll be able to figure out what Hashem's intention was. He creates in food, which has to be consumed, He creates imperfection. There is no food which is perfect. There is no food which is completely balanced. There is no single food that has everything in it, that has nothing, no waste product in it, and that has all that we need. Why not? That would be the simplest way to handle it. Imagine how much time and effort and money could be saved if food was dispensed in little bottles and you just had to take a tablet, and the tablet contained all the chemicals you need, enough protein and enough carbohydrates and enough fat and enough vitamins, and that's it. It theoretically shouldn't be impossible to achieve. And if food could be dispensed in that way, number one, we would save all the time of eating. 2, we would save all the time of preparation of food. 3, we would save all the money in preparation of food, and all the time that we have to put into earning a living in order to pay for the preparation of food. It would cut out an awful amount of wasted time and energy. So if the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to create a perfect world, surely one of the first things he should have done was to have made the process of eating much more simple, cheaper and more simple. That would be the obvious way to do it. And why has he created a system that demands so much complexity in its usage? Says the Midrash, but that's how it is. The fact is, food is not perfect. There is no single food that's perfect. And we need a variety. And only by the variety of foods can we establish a balanced diet. But the fact that we need the variety means that just as in each item of food there is not everything that we need, so in each item of food there are things that we don't need. So how does the body cope with that? That's through a complex and sophisticated digestive system. Says the Medrash, that's how we have to cope with imperfections. We have to learn how to digest the world around us. We have to learn how to integrate the world around us without getting heartburn and without getting ulcers and without getting constipation. We need to learn how to have an ability to take in things, to sort them out, to reject what needs to be rejected, and to slowly absorb what needs to be absorbed. And it can't be done quickly. We're absorbing difficult things, and things particularly nowadays are taking place so fast in every sphere, in every field. The changes that are taking place in the world are taking place at a rate that it is almost impossible to integrate them. Things that used to take hundreds of years are now taking days and at most weeks to take place. In the technological area, in the political area, in the human area, in virtually every area in which we operate, we find things taking place at a pace which is almost impossible to integrate. But we have to try, we have to work on that, on the ability to digest what is taking place, to digest what is happening. And we don't do that enough. That whole process of digestion is the area that we're ignoring perhaps more than any other in our lives. And it's in every area, including in the way we eat. The way we eat is with such lack of menuchas nefesh, with such a lack of leisure, that it's questionable whether we're in fact able to absorb the nutritiousness that we need, and to be able to be affected by our food in the way that we're meant to be affected by our food. Everything's in a hurry, everything's in a rush. We prepare the food in a rush, we eat the food in a rush, we get up from the table in a rush. There's no time devoted to the process of integration, to the process of digestion, the understanding that eating is not enough. The food has to be properly absorbed too. But it's not just food, it applies to all areas. We come into a shiur, we rush out of a shiur. We come into one event, we go out into, and we switch from one thing to another, and we're moving backwards and forwards, doing all sorts of things, and the more shiurim we go to, the better it is, and we hear this in one shiur and that in another shiur, and we don't quite remember what we heard in which one, or whether we heard it right in the first place, and everything's a complete mumble-jumble in our minds, and so we carry on as we go through life, thinking we're growing wonderfully, because we went to 25 shiurim today. It's like saying, you know how healthy I am. I ate 25 suppers this evening. I had one supper at so-and-so, another supper at so-and-so, and another one. Then I rushed over there, and they were still having dessert, and when I finished there, I rushed over to the other place, and they were busy on hors d'oeuvres, so I had some hors d'oeuvres with them as well. I had supper with 25 people this evening. Isn't that wonderful? Whew. And now we start breakfast tomorrow morning. I'm going to do the same thing again. Isn't that wonderful? It isn't wonderful. It's sick. But how can it be sick if one breakfast is healthy? Surely 10 breakfasts are more healthy? It's not like that. Eat one breakfast properly, and one lunch properly, and one supper properly, and that's healthy. And the whole process of digestion is something that we're not giving attention to. The process of digestion, since we don't see the results of the digestive process immediately, it's something we feel that we can, why waste time on it? We finished lunch, we can now do something. Why waste time digesting, so to say? We've had a shiur, we can now do something else, we can go to another shiur. Why spend time digesting the shiur that you've just had? And yet the digestion of that shiur is as important as is the listening to the shiur in the first place. It's totally useless to listen to a shiur, or to read a book, or to hear a lecture, or to experience an event, and not spend any time on the digestive process. The result, the end result is virtually useless. But that doesn't seem to bother us, because we can tick up another few things that we've done. That's not the way to operate. People do that when they travel a lot. They rush from place to place, looking at this and looking at that, and into this museum and into that art gallery, and out and onto a tour and off a tour, and they come back having seen an awful lot. But what really can possibly be integrated? You cannot integrate things at that kind of rate and at that kind of pace. And so the Medrash teaches us that in a world of imperfection, the solution lies not in the seeking of perfection. That's a hopeless pursuit. Put all the time that you put into seeking perfection, rather put into developing the skills of integration, developing the skills of digestion, and you'll find that you can handle the imperfections without them destroying you. You don't have to get bothered by them. And so we see from this medrash that zero defect can exist in the animal, zero defect can exist in an object, but not in the human being. Why not? There's another medrash a little further on. Dabero b'nei Yisrael le'mer nefesh ki techeto. It's a medrash in Parsha Dalet. Speak to b'nei Yisrael if an individual sins. Tani Rabbi Yishma. Rabbi Shmuel learned Moshol le'melech shehoyolei pardes v'hoyolo b'chayos nois. This is compared to a king who has an orchard with beautiful fruit ready. V'hoyshiv boi ha'melech shemrim. And the king puts guards into the orchard to make sure that nobody steals. Echod higer ve'echod sumo. One guard is lame and one guard is blind. The Omar, like the kind of guards that you can hire from the security companies. The Omar lohen, and he said to them, Hizoru al bechorus hanos ha'ele. Be careful, watch out for these beautiful fruits. Leyomim Omar higer l'sumo. After a few days, the lame god says to the blind god, "Bechorus nois ani roya befardes. I see the most beautiful fruit in this paradis. I feel sorry for you that you can't see what I can see. Beautiful fruit." Omar le suma said the suma said the blind man, "Have a vamechel." That's interesting, says the blind man. "Let's eat. Let's eat." Omar le chige said the lame man, "I would love to, but I can't move. I'm lame." Omar Suma said, "The blind man, I can't see. You can't walk. Can I see?" Rochav Chigir Agabi Suma. So the lame man sat on the shoulders of the blind man. And they ate the fruit. And each one went and sat in his own place. They formed a team. So with the lame man on top of the blind man, he directed the blind man, the blind man walked, and that's how they achieved it. Leyomim nichnas ha-melech ba'isri pardes. A little while later, the king came to the orchard. Omar le'en hechaneim ha-becheres ha-nois, where is all my fruit? Omar le'isumu, said the blind man, Adoni ha-melech, my master, the king, v'chi re'ani. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. I can't even see them. Never mind, know where they are. Omar lo chige, said the lame man, Adoni ha-melech, v'chi yochel ani la'aloch. Can I walk, said the lame man. I couldn't possibly have taken them. Even if I can see them, but I couldn't have taken them. I can't move. Osa ha-melech shuyopiech, b'keach me'o. So that king who was wise, what did he do? Hirkiv chige ra'gabi sumo. He put the lame man on top of the blind man. V'ischilu ma'alchir, and they walked. This is what you must have done in order to eat the fruit. So in time to come, Hashem is going to say to the nefesh, to the soul, so why did you sin before me? And the soul will answer, I didn't sin. Me? What did I do wrong? It's the body that sinned. And the proof is, Mishoshi Yotzasi Mimenu, since the death of this person, when I was freed, Ketzipo Tehiro Perachas Be'avirani, I'm like a free bird flying in the sky. Have you seen me do anything wrong since the day of the death? Since we left that body behind in the grave, have I done anything wrong? So don't blame me, it's the body. Himel Luguf, Hashem says to the body, Mipnei Mach Atasa Lefanai, why did you sin before me? Omar Lefanov, he says, Ribbeinu Elamim, Ani Lo Chotasi, I didn't sin. Neshama Hi Shechoto. It's the neshama, it wasn't me. And the proof is, Mishoshi Yotzeso Mimeni, since you took the neshama away, Ke'evin Shushlach Agabi Karka Ani Nishlach. I'm like a stone lying on the ground, since I've been lying in the grave. Have you seen me do anything wrong? Have you seen me get up to any mischief? It's not me, it's the neshama. V'dan Shneim Ke'echod, and Hashem judges the two together. What is the concept here? What is the principle here? We said that an object in an object there can be zero defect. Now zero defect can come from one of two things. Either because a zero also has zero defect. If there's nothing in something, then there's no defect in it either. So either there's no defect because there's nothing to start with, or there's no defect because what there is so absolutely pure. So it's the two extremes. You've either got zero, or you've got infinity. And at either extreme you can have, so to say, zero defect. The problem is in the middle. In an object you can have zero defect. And what's important to understand is that the neshama and the guf are each objects. Neither of them alone are subjects. The neshama and the guf are each objects. How do we mean? For example, that take the neshama. The soul has got eyes, but it's lame, can't act. The soul is like the chiga. And the body is like the blind person. Can't see, can't visualize, can't think, but it's mobile, it can move. And these are the two beings from which the human being is constructed. And let's take each of them. Take the neshama. The neshama is infinitely pure. It's a spark of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. And the neshama alone doesn't sin. And the neshama turns to Hashem and he says, since you took me out of that body, have I done anything wrong? Of course not. The neshama alone doesn't sin. Why not? Because it's absolutely pure. But that absolute purity is an object, not a subject. Why? Because a subject, in order to be a subject, you need to have something to act on. You need to be able to act on an object. In other words, when you're talking about a subject and an object, there must be a relationship. One thing on its own, no matter how powerful it is, no matter how potent it is, if it isn't able to function, if it isn't able to operate on something, it's not a subject, it's an object, it's a thing. So the neshama, although the neshama can visualize, although the neshama can think, although the neshama is pure, although the neshama is part of Hashem Yisborach, so to say, at the end of the day, the neshama is not a subject because it cannot act, it's not mobile, it's like the lame person. There's nothing it can do except be itself. To be yourself, no matter how pure you'll be. You're pure, you're yourself, but you're not a subject, there is no relationship, you're not operating on anything at all. The guf, the body, is the blind man. The blind man is mobile, he can get around, he can act. But he's also not a subject, he's also an object. Why? What is the role of the lame man, of the neshama? And what is the role of the blind man, of the guf, the body? And why does the Medrash use this specific image to relate to the relationship, to the partnership between body and soul? There are two levels on which the eye must be understood. The one is the physical level, which is not what the Medrash talks about. The physical level is one can see things around and about one. But we're referring here to an image with a neshama, to an image of the soul. In the sense of the image of the soul, the eye's function is much more than to see the things that are around and about one. The function of the eye in the image of the soul is to see things which are not around and about one. The soul has the ability to visualize. There's a difference between seeing and visualizing. Seeing, you are reacting to your environment. Visualizing, you are creating your environment. It's a completely different thing. And that's the power of the neshama. The neshama has the ability to create a vision, to create something which doesn't exist in its mind, to be able to see something which doesn't exist, to be able to put things together into a vision that might be a realistic vision. But there's a difference between something being realistic and something being real. The neshama is able to visualize. That's the eyes. To create from within itself its vision of the future. That's what the neshama can do. The guf can't do that. The body can't do that. Doesn't have eyes. It's lame. What can the body do? The body can react. And the body reacts to the senses. What makes the body move? There's the lame man over there. What makes him move? What makes him do anything? What motivates him? He's motivated by his senses. By the feeling of pleasantness or the feeling of pain. If he feels something nice, he'll react in one way. If he feels something uncomfortable, he'll react in another way to remove the discomfort. And so he's able to use his eyes, his able let's take the blind man who's mobile, is able to use all his senses, and he's able to react and he's able to move in order to achieve more of that pleasant sensation. So if you take the blind man and you show him the taste of this lovely fruit, and you tell him take 10 steps forward and 3 steps to the left, and there's plenty more of that, where there's plenty more of that you can get, he'll take the 10 steps forward and the 3 steps left, and he'll eat the fruit. But that eating of the fruit is the result of the sensation. He is reacting to sensation. He is not creating a vision. Completely different thing. The neshama can create a vision of its own and then guide the body to react. And so the partnership has to exist. The neshama can visualize. The body reacts. Let's take it a step further. The body, again in the image, it's the blind one, is only capable of reacting to that which exists in its environment. That's all it can do. And it reacts to comfort and it reacts to discomfort. The neshama is able to take itself right out of its environment and to operate as if it's in a different environment altogether. It can imagine itself being in a different environment altogether. Its problem, however, is it cannot affect its environment. And so each one is a terribly helpless being. The body can perceive its environment and react to its environment, and it can change its environment, but to what will it change it? It has no vision of anything other than its environment. You take an animal, you take a dog, and you raise him in a particular yard, and you say to the dog, you know, if you want to change anything around here, it's fine. If you want to move your kennel to another place, and you want to move, you can do it. Dogs don't. Why don't they do it? Because they're unable to visualize their yard as something else. And even if it's badly structured, even if the kennel is in a noisy place and the food bin or the food dish is in a smelly place, the animal doesn't move it. Because he can't visualize the possibility of things being different. So if you move the kennel, he'll follow, then he'll sleep in a new place. So you can change his place of sleeping if you change the environment. You can control the dog by changing the environment and he will respond to that change. But to visualize a different environment and to effect change himself, that he can't do. What I'm suggesting is that to change your environment, it's not good enough to be physically potent. You've got to have a vision of an alternative environment. If you have a vision of an alternative environment, you can start moving your existing environment towards that vision of the changed environment. The neshama has all the visions, has no difficulty with the visions. But it can't do anything. It can't move, it can't walk, it can't handle things, can't operate on things. It's impotent in that sense. So each of these has a unique power which is totally useless without the other. The neshama can have the vision, the body can affect, but the body without the neshama cannot do anything, and the neshama without the body cannot do anything. And so the Derech Hashem says in the 8th Perek of the first Chelek, the human being is unique, because the human being is a synthesis of two types, of two species of creation, totally separate and opposite. The highest of souls with the lowest of bodies, what you don't have in any other being. And here you've got to be very careful not to make a mistake. That you don't consider for one moment animals to be like human beings, just on a different level. Because the nefesh of an animal, the nefesh, the life force, that which is the living part of the animal, is something material, it's not spiritual. It's a very fine piece of matter. It's something which borders on spirituality, it borders on a soul, but it isn't a soul. An animal doesn't have a soul. And man also has such a nefesh, a life force, which is part of his body, not part of his spirit. But added to that, man has this highest form of neshama, shehi min briyo bifnei atzma, which is a completely different creation. separate from the body totally and distant from it totally. Shebov and Nikshiro Boy Bigzeirosoi, which Hashem has attached to the body. Ala Kavonosh is a chanda for reasons which we've discussed. And this is where we find enormous areas of error in the way we handle things today. Because we often don't realize how scientific theories affect moral standing too. How they can affect everything. We tend to think that each area of knowledge is affected by its own theories, and that's all. Each one can be closed off separately, but it isn't like that. Paul Johnson shows in one of his works how it was Einstein's theory of relativity which set the decay of moral standards, which set off the decay of moral standards. The principle of relativity was the denial of an absolute. And although that's not what he himself believed, that's not what Einstein believed, and he later on made it very clear that that's not what he believed, but the introduction of the concept of relativity into science led to the acceptance of relativity and the abandonment of objectivity in all areas. And that was a removal away from emunah. People left God at that time, people left absolutes at that time, and started searching for all sorts of alternatives. And that's where in every area at that time, in art and in music and in all over, at that same period of time, you had an abandonment of classical objective standards and a search for new subjective standards, impressionism, in art and so on. And so it was also with the theory of evolution of Darwin. The essence is not a question of whether man was created this way or that way or how the world was. That's not the whole discussion. There's something much more serious that results from it. And that is the whole psychological attitude towards man resulting from a subconscious acceptance of the theory of Darwin. That man is nothing but a sophisticated animal. The moment you consider man as nothing but a sophisticated animal, no matter how sophisticated you consider him to be, there's no way you can begin to understand the human being. Because the human being explains the Derech Hashem, and the Medrash we've been learning is that combination of the Chiger and the Sumo, of the Neshoma and the Guf, the body and the soul. And medicine sees only the body, and psychiatry sees only the body, and psychology, even psychology, sees only the body. If a psychologist starts talking about the soul, they write him off. He's struck off the roll virtually, and people are discouraged from going to see him. That's not acceptable. You can't talk in science about things which are not scientific, and the neshama is not scientific, and therefore they exclude it. So all they're dealing with is, for them, that they're like the king who's not a piker. Imagine the king would come in and say, who stole the fruit? And he would bring in the psychologists, and he would bring in the doctors, he would bring everybody in. All they see is nobody could have stolen the fruit. The blind man couldn't see, and the lame man couldn't walk, so nobody did. It's not possible. The king who was a pikeach, says the Medrash, he was a clever man, a wise man, realized the power that existed when the two got together. Much more than the sum of both of them was achieved when the two get together. And in order to understand man, one has to understand the neshama, one has to understand its potential and its limitations. One has to understand the guf, the body, its potential and its limitations. And one has to be able to put the two together. There is no way psychology can understand human behavior. There is no way psychiatry can understand human behavior. They will make mistakes, and they will continue to make mistakes, and they will destroy people in the process of making those mistakes because of their denial of the relationship between guf and neshama. It doesn't mean there's no saving grace, that they don't do good work too. They do. But in essence, the fundamentals will never be properly understood. And so we see that the guf on its own is an object. It's an object. It cannot visualize, and if it cannot have a vision, it cannot operate on its environment. And if it's an object, it can have zero defect. The neshama, the soul, is also an object. Although it can visualize, it also cannot act on its environment. It can visualize something different to its environment. It primarily visualizes things different to its environment. It is in no way bound to its environment. But having visualized that alternative, there's nothing it can do about its environment. It cannot change its environment. It too is an object. And as such, the object of the neshama with all its purity and the object of the body with all its sterility can both achieve zero defect. If something is absolutely pure, it can have zero defect. If something is absolutely sterile, it can have zero defect. What happens when you put the two together? You no longer have an object, you have something new, you have a new bria, a completely new creation called man. He's not a body and he's not a soul. This is a new creation, which is a connection, which is a synthesis of body and soul. The ability to have vision, as the soul has, with the ability to operate on the environment as the body has. That you can no longer have zero defect. When you've got those two together, you can no longer have zero defect, you can no longer have imperfect, you can no longer have perfection. The body is no longer sterile because it is affected by the vision. And the soul is no longer pure because it's affected by the body. And once there is that, you've denied this new being of the purity, of the absolute purity of the soul, and you've denied him of the absolute sterility of the body, and you've given him a new dynamic. You've given him the opportunity to affect his environment, to change his environment, to master his environment. But the cost of that dynamic is the loss of purity. The cost of that dynamic is the loss of perfection. And so we accept that man can never go onto the Mizbeach, man can't go onto the altar. The same as Hashem won't accept any animal which is not perfect. There's no way Hashem can accept a human being. For other reasons also not. There's no intention that man should ever come onto the altar. But does man play a role in the Beis HaMikdash? Yes, of course he does. Man is able to bring the animal onto the Mizbeach. Man performs the korban. Man performs the sacrifice. It's all very well saying you need an object which is perfect. And you need an environment which is perfect to sacrifice.